Good pleasure of introducing Dave Bailey. Dave and I lived in the same ward for a number of years and worked together in a variety of ways and have been associated with Sunstone for a long time together as well. Dave is a computer scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. He served a mission during the early 70s in Hong Kong, and during that time he was instrumental in helping to translate the Doctrine and Covenants into Chinese. David and his wife Linda live here in Alamo, not too far away, across the bay. David is, from my point of view, the foundation or the solid aspect of the Iring L Church and Mormonism and Science email list. I'm also on that list. I'm not a scientist by any sense of the word. I'm sort of a frustrated physicist. That's what I studied at Berkeley when I was there, but went on into the business world. So I lurk in the backgrounds and of the Iring L list, and it has evolved over time significantly. And David Bailey is the one person who always brings it back to the essential discussion of what's going on on the list. It has a tendency to drift once in a while, and then someone will bring up evolution, and it comes back to the stream of evolution that's always on the Iring L list. And it'll go up to the other side, and then someone will bring up evolution, and it comes back again. It's an interesting experience to watch this process go on. I've asked Dave to come and present a paper that he wrote specifically, as from my point of view, in response to some of the discussions that were going on the list regarding creationism and a propensity of Mormon scientists that are on the list to maybe adopt this concept of new creationism. And it was David who wrote this paper and brought the list back to really look at the details and the aspects of new creationism and make sure that we didn't let the lesser rigorous members of the list have a de facto say that this is actually a good way to look at creationism. So David, go ahead.
Thank you, Richard, that very kind introduction. It is quite literally true. I wrote this paper partly because of the discussion on this list and partly out of some of the recent reading that I've been doing, and in general because of the concern I've had for the general drift of the church during, say, the past 10 or 20 years to what may be described as evangelical Christian orthodoxy, and sometimes termed as Mormon neo-orthodoxy, which is exhibited in the scientific arena as a preference and an appeal to creationism. In one sense, perhaps almost all Latter-day Saints would be described as a creationist. I myself am described as a creationist by some of my scientific colleagues because I have a belief in God and the general belief. Keep the door closed, I think it'll be easier. So I'm sure all of us in some sense believe that God is the oversaw the creation of the world, and that the universe, the earth, and us all have some transcendent purpose. Indeed, the LDS scriptures declare that worlds without numbers have I created. But in another sense, only a few of us are formally affiliated with what is commonly called the scientific creationist movement that is now developing within the U.S. Nonetheless, certainly creationist views that seem to appeal to many LDS people, and at least one LDS scientist played a key role in the development of the creationist movement, as we'll see in a minute. In this paper, we're going to define creationism, also sometimes said as scientific creationism or creation science, as it was defined in a 1981 Arkansas law, namely as belief in 1, a sudden creation of the universe, energy, and life from nothing; 2, the insufficiency of mutation and natural selection in bringing about the development of living kinds; and 3, changes only within certain fixed limits of the originally created kinds of plants and animals; 4, separate ancestry for man and apes; 5, an explanation of the Earth's geology by catastrophism, notably the occurrence of a worldwide flood; and 6, a relatively recent inception of the Earth and the life upon it. Advocates of this view, which is obviously biblical literalism, without explicit references to God, Adam, and Noah, hold that there was no life on Earth before Eden a few thousand years ago and no death before the fall. The creationist movement is currently very strong in the U.S. and growing rapidly in popularity. In 1991, a Gallup poll showed that 47% of the public, including 25% of college students, agreed that God created man pretty much in his current state at one time within the last 10,000 years. In the 1980s, Arkansas and Louisiana passed laws requiring equal treatment for creation science and evolution in public schools, although subsequently the courts have reversed those statutes. More recently, the Alabama legislature has passed a law requiring the public school teachers, prior to discussing evolution, read a disclaimer that states that it is only a controversial theory believed by some scientists. And it's narrowly defeated just a few weeks ago a measure that would have required that teachers instruct students to pencil in theory beside any mention of the word evolution in their textbook, and then also to pencil in false data beside any mention of a geological age or a radiocarbon age more than just a few years ago. In Kansas, creationists quietly elected a majority to the state school board and then removed any mention of old Earth, macroevolution, or the Big Bang from the curriculum. Although in an uproar subsequently, again, this has been reversed, but other activities are continuing. As of the present time, there's activities going on in Arkansas, Idaho, Michigan, Montana, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Washington. And I've just been informed of a couple others that I didn't list here. Surveys among LDS people seem to indicate similar trends. In a 1935 survey of BYU students, only 36 questioned that humans had been created in a process of evolution from lower life forms. 36%. But in 1973, the figure had risen to 81%. And in a recent, namely this year, survey of introductory biology students at BYU, 48% agreed that while evolution might apply to some limited circumstances, it does not cross boundaries which separate major categories of plants and animals, and it may apply to lower forms but not to man. 21% students expressed that the belief that the Earth is only a few thousand years old, and 50% agreed that creationism and evolution should be given equal time in public schools. A recently published and highly popular LDS documentary written by a BYU religion professor rules out evolution and holds that there was no death before the fall, which occurred less than 7,000 years ago. Okay, let's look at some historical background. How did this creationist movement come to be? I was originally going to start this paper out by saying that much of what your children currently learn or do not learn in public schools about biology, and much of what is taught in the U.S. and commonly, or in the LDS Church, and is commonly believed in the LDS Church, had its roots in the wild-eyed visions of a obscure 19th century religious leader. Nonetheless, that's true. Here's how it happened. Back in the when evolution was first described in 1859 by Charles Darwin, there initially was quite a backlash among religious leaders. However, even by the end of the 19th century, Christians of various denominations had more or less made peace with the evolution and the conventional old earth worldview. And it's interesting to notice that some of you may recall William Jennings Bryan, who led the anti-evolution crusade in the 1920s. He personally interpreted the days of Genesis as being geological eras of possibly very long length, and he allowed for a limited evolution. Was fine with him. But anyway, what was about at the same time, there was a fellow, a self-taught geologist named George McCready Price. He could arguably the founder of the modern-day creationist movement. He was a devout member of the Seventh-day Adventist sect, and which was an offshoot of the 19th century movement led by one Ellen G. White. And one of White's key teachings was that the Fourth Commandment mandates Saturday worship and a literal belief in Genesis. In one of her visions, she was shown that the creation week was just like every other week. In subsequent writing, she taught that Noah's flood was a worldwide event, and that after the flood waters had subsided, God caused a powerful wind to pass over the earth, which buried the dead animal bodies with trees, stone, and earth. These buried forests subsequently became coal and oil, which God occasionally ignited to produce earthquakes and volcanoes. Anyway, so in the 1930s, George McCready Price was investigating some of these things. He was intrigued by Ellen White's visions of the creation. And so in several books that he subsequently authored, Price basically follows this same line. He described that much modern science is in the highest degree improbable and absurd. He focused his attack on geology. Following White, Price asserted that a recent creation, just in the last few thousand years, and a literal Noah's flood. To Price, flood explained why the fossils appear in a predictable sequence. The floodwaters first killed smaller animals, followed by vertebrate fishes, and finally larger animals and man, who fled to the hilltops to escape the rushing floodwaters. And then again, following Ellen G. White's teachings, Price suggested that there was a miraculous cosmic storm that buried all these bodies, and thus the fossil record merely reveals a sorting of the contemporary antediluvian life forms, and the conventional geological scheme is a delusion. Interestingly, some of the more modern creationist works follow the same outline and the same general concept, that all of geology was simply the result of Noah's flood. And yeah, there's more modern or more advanced animals towards the top of the geological column only because they avoided the floodwaters, the rising floodwaters, longer. Perhaps a more popular work of recent decades is a book called The Genesis Flood by Whitcomb and Morris. And again, following Price's book, this book starts with an affirmation of the authority and infallibility of the Bible. They argue that since the scriptures clearly describe a universal flood, Christian believers have two choices: either reject God's inspired word or reject the testimony of thousands of professional geologists. So these authors reject the geologists. And according to them, God created the entire universe and populated the earth, fully grown plants, animals, and human beings, all in six literal days, using methods and processes completely different from any now operation in the universe. There's no death before the fall, so consequently all the fossils are the remains of animals that perished in the flood subsequent to the fall. And again, they explain the geological column according to hydrodynamic sorting of organisms in the floodwaters. They acknowledge that by some indications, the Earth and the universe appear to be very old. I mean, for instance, the evidence that of light rays streaming to Earth from stars that are millions or billions of years of light years away. But they explain that an omnipotent creator could easily have created them with this appearance of age. One interesting item in the book is a mention of some human footprints bound together with dinosaur tracks near the Biloxi River in Texas. And this contradicts the notion that humans appeared many millions of years after the dinosaurs became extinct. There's another book that's come out recently, a creationist book called Scientific Creationism. In this book, one of the things it mentions is that it argues that the amount of dust, or if the Earth and the Moon were really as old as scientists say, that the Moon would have been covered with approximately 180 feet of dust. And given that the astronauts found only just a small fraction of an inch, well, it's clear that conventional scientific ages are all wrong. And they also argue that this what's known as the second law of thermodynamics fundamentally forbids biological evolution. Very good. You're learning. So what's an LDS connection to this? Well, as it turns out, in the 1920s, the same time that this George McCready Price was writing his creationist books, that was the foundation of modern creationism, Joseph Field Smith discovered these books and quickly became enamored with his findings. He was particularly impressed by Price's syllogism that no Adam, no fall. No fall, no atonement. No atonement, no Savior. So he actually corresponded with Price a number of letters, encouraging him in his efforts to defeat evolution. And then he began, Joseph Fielding Smith began writing a manuscript laying out what he regarded as the LDS case against evolution. Not long after, some of you are aware that there was a dispute arose between Joseph Fielding Smith, B.H. Roberts, and James E. Talmadge. Joseph Fielding wanted to go ahead and publish this anti-evolution manuscript, but Roberts had been working on a manuscript of his own that acknowledged what he called pre-Adamites, and acknowledged pretty more or less the conventional scientific view of an old Earth. In the course of these discussions, Joseph Fielding promoted this book by Edward McCready Price to the fellow general authorities. James E. Talmadge, of course, was a degree geologist, and he was very skeptical of this material, but he himself had sort of personally acknowledged that the conventional evolution and geology was fine, but he didn't have the time to really investigate this, so he asked his son Sterling Talmadge, who was in New Mexico and a professor of geology and mineralogy there, to look into this more. Sterling replied that the new geology was not new, nor did it contain any real geology. He says, with these two corrections, the title remains the best part of the book. He added further that a lot of these arguments were absurd. But meantime, the debate over evolution in 1931 among the LDS authorities was stopped by the first presidency, who finally just wrote a letter saying, leave geology, biology, archaeology, and anthropology, no one of which has to do with the salvation of the souls of mankind, to scientific research while we magnify our calling in the realm of the church. So there it stood until 1954. This is after B.H. Roberts and Talmadge had passed away. Joseph Fielding Smith then reworked this manuscript of his on evolution into the book Man, His Origin and Destiny. Some of you are familiar with this. This book argues basically that not only is the theory of evolution unacceptable for doctrinal reasons, but it's citing a lot of references to Price's book, he argues that it's invalid science as well. David O. McKay, who was then president of the church and who personally accepted evolution, reassured several who wrote to his office that this book represented only the author's opinion, namely Joseph Fielding Smith, and that the Church does not have an official view on the subject of evolution. Nonetheless, many of these views were subsequently incorporated into Joseph Fielding's, into Bruce R. McConkie's book, Mormon Doctrine. And as you're aware, even 40 years after its original publication, it remains the most widely cited LDS doctrinal reference. Meantime, an LDS scientist gave a substantial boost to this growing creationist movement. Dr. Melvin Cook, professor of metallurgy at the University of Utah and an internationally renowned explosive expert, was impressed by the arguments of Price as well as the teachings of Joseph Fielding Smith. He declared after some of his research that radiocarbon dates were all wrong and they should all be telescoped down to a maximum of 13,000 years, which is in keeping with the notion that the 7 days of creation each represent 1,000 years and that 6,000 years had transpired since the creation. Other LDS scientists, notably Dr. Henry Eyring of the University of Utah, dismissed Cook's views, but Cook continued his research and subsequently published two creationist books. Furthermore, Cook was invited to join the newly organized Creation Research Society, which was founded by a number of the evangelical scholars that had published and been doing some of this other creation research. And Cook's international reputation led substantial credibility to the society. Cook was awarded the Nitro Nobel Gold Medal, which is granted periodically for outstanding contributions to the field of explosives. He received this award in the same year that his articles began to appear in the Creation Research Quarterly. So where do we stand today? In the past few years, there's been a new group of creationists that have arisen, that's sometimes called the New Creationism or Intelligent Design Creationism. And they've adopted a somewhat different strategy than their predecessors. They tend to downplay things like flood geology and a recent six-day creation. And they focus on a smaller set of fundamental notions that have been where they try to sanitize it of explicit references to deity and to specific sectarian religious doctrines. According to UC Berkeley law professor Philip Johnson, who's one of the central figures in this movement, the key notion of this intelligent design school is that there exists a personal creator, often described as an intelligent designer, who is supernatural and who initiated and continues to control the process of creation in furtherance of some end or purpose. Johnson argues that there is a fundamental and unproven dogma underlying much of modern science, especially evolution. This is the assumption of scientific naturalism, namely the philosophy that empirical nature is all there is and all that we can have any solid knowledge about. As a result, Johnson argues, the hypothesis that a god or an intelligent designer was involved in the creation is systematically excluded from scientific discourse. He suggested if scientists remove these naturalistic blinders, they might see the creation in a new light. Johnson frequently attacks evolution, arguing, for example, that the fossil record does not indicate smooth transition between major branches of the biological kingdom, but instead supports an independent creation point of view. Another leader of this independent design school of creationism is Mike Behe of Lehigh University. He argues that certain biological features are irreducibly complex, which means that they are composed of several interacting parts, the removal of any one of which would cause the system to cease functioning. He cites as examples the complex molecular machinery involved in vision, blood clotting, and in the movement of flagella. He then argues that it is impossibly unlikely that these components could have separately evolved only later to fit into the unified system that we see in the organism today. Other creationists argue that the formation of certain biological proteins is impossibly unlikely. For instance, the alpha hemoglobin protein of human blood consists of a chain, a protein chain of 141 amino acids. And they argue that it is impossibly unlikely that this molecule could have just formed at random. Despite their outwardly open-minded approach to the creation, the IDC community, in other words, the Intelligent Design Creationism community, has no tolerance for evolution, even theistic evolution, namely the belief that God directs the course of evolution. William Dembski, a prominent IDC writer, makes this clear. He says, "Design theorists are no friends of theistic evolution. As far as design theorists are concerned, theistic evolution is American evangelicalism's ill-conceived accommodation to Darwinism." This Philip Johnson is even more explicit. He describes the IDC strategy as a wedge, which is designed to split the ranks of theistic evolutionists and others who hold that evolution is compatible with religion. So what is the scientific evidence? Where does the conventional scientific world stand today? Michael Ruse, a philosopher of science who testified in this 1981 creationism case in Alabama, he describes science as a discipline that, one, is guided by natural law, two, is explanatory by reference to natural law, three, is testable against the empirical world, four, reaches conclusions that are tentative, and five, is falsifiable. So how does creationism measure up against these standards? And for that matter, how do the conventional theories of geology and biology measure up? With regard to the traditional scientific theories, I would have to say at this point in time that the picture of the Earth as approximately 4.5 billion years old, with fossil remnants of a branching tree of creation extending from primitive bacteria to ultimately to man in the past few million years, is very well established. Geological dates are particularly well established, confirmed by numerous independent schemes, many of which rely on fundamental nuclear processes. These processes, in turn, are well understood based upon quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics, in turn, is observed to be operating in distant stars, based on the light that we now see, which left those stars millions and billions of years ago. In other words, the same quantum mechanical laws that we see today, we observe were operating in the same way in the far distant past on those distant stars. Thus, we have very good reason to believe that these geological dating schemes, which are based on quantum mechanics, are very reliable as clocks into the distant past. As far as the fossil record, until recently, that's basically all we had to rely on to infer the course of evolution over time. But in the past few decades, some new tools have arisen, notably comparisons of DNA and amino acid sequences. These new tools have confirmed, with very few exceptions, the traditional taxonomy of the biological world. To cite just one example, this 141-long amino acid, or this 141-long alpha hemoglobin molecule, which is in your human blood, is identical in chimpanzees. It differs by only one location in gorillas, by 18 locations in horses, 25 in rabbits, but by approximately 100 locations in various fish species. Evolution is still a theory in the sense that there are many details of the course that evolution has taken that remains to be worked out. And the relative importance of natural selection, mutations, environmental change is still being debated. But the central notion that an evolutionary process has occurred over many millions of years is not seriously in doubt. In comparison, first of all, we should point out that the creationists, as far as anyone can tell, a number of people have done some literature checks. They do not even attempt to submit their work to respected scientific peer-reviewed journals. They may have degrees, they may have very impressive-sounding arguments, but their work has not been peer-reviewed. It has certainly not appeared in scientific journals. And as far as anyone can tell, they do not even attempt to publish it. What about some of the issues that they're raised? Again, in the interest of time, I have a lot of material here in my book. To my article, you can come and look up afterwards. I don't have time to go into a lot of this, but I'd like to just mention just a couple of cases. Just as, for instance, we mentioned earlier this argument about space dust, about how that the moon, if it were really billions of years old, it should be covered with hundreds of feet of dust. As it turns out, this claim was based on a 1960 study published in Scientific American of the space dust infall rate that was estimated from some measurements made at the summit of Mauna Loa in Hawaii. However, later, when the actual dust flow rate was actually directly measured by spacecraft out in space, it turns out that the result was lower by a factor of more than 100. And so when these corrections are made, the small amount of dust that the astronaut found is completely consistent with scientific theories. Now, these facts that I just mentioned, that was made known to the creationist community at least 25 years ago. Yet they continue to advance this argument. It is in the latest year 2000 printing of Morris's Scientific Creationism, and among other places. This has prompted one scientist, who himself is a Christian theist, to comment, "The continuing publication of those claims by young Earth advocates constitutes an intolerable violation of the standards of professional integrity that should characterize the work of natural scientists." These Paluxy River tracks of human footprints adjacent to dinosaur footprints has been completely refuted, that careful studies show that these human prints are really dinosaur prints. In fact, based on these results, an evangelical scientist, a creationist himself, commented in a creationist article that it was no longer appropriate for them to continue to use this as evidence against evolution. But nonetheless, it continues to be done. 12 years later, there was a TV show that was narrated by Carlton Heston that was arguing that much of modern science is along this line is false, and that was one of their evidences that they mentioned. So it goes on and on like this. There are many other things I won't mention. There's just one thing that I'll briefly comment on here is about these arguments of probability. Like that they do calculations of probability that this hemoglobin molecule or some other DNA structure could have been the result of random evolution. And they say that this probability is some fantastically small number, thus proving that the conventional random evolutionary model is false. Anytime you hear this, I'd like you to think of the following. Around here we don't have any snow, but if you do visit somewhere, take a look at a snowflake sometime. Here's a picture of two real life snowflakes. There's a book that you can find in libraries that's called Snow Crystals that includes over 2,000 high resolution photos of real snowflakes. These are fantastically improbable. I did a calculation of what is the probability that, say, one of these sectors would exactly be symmetric with the, in other words, the six-way symmetry with the others. You get figures like 10 to the minus 1,500 power. In other words, a 1 followed by 1,500 zeros. Impossibly unlikely, but is this an argument that God handcrafts each and every snowflake that falls? Hardly. The snowflakes form, even though they superficially violate the second law of thermodynamics, it's being done under well-known physical laws and nothing is violated. And so anytime you hear one of these arguments saying, is there anything in that argument that wouldn't also apply to snowflakes? And the answer is no. So be forewarned. How are we coming? Or maybe I need to just wind up here. I just might quickly comment, like Philip Johnson's, one of his themes, this creationist Philip Johnson that's over at UC Berkeley, he mentions this assumption of scientific naturalism, and that he suggests that this systematically excludes the notion of a designer. But scientific point of view, what good is that concept scientifically? the hypothesis of intelligent designer can literally be invoked any time one wishes. Nature is this way because an intelligent designer made it that way, and it is futile and possibly disrespectful to seek any further explanation. All of science would stop. All in any field, not just evolution, but chemistry, physics, sociology, everything would stop. Why is it this way? That's just the way the Creator made it, and there's no point in seeking any further or natural explanation. So, you know, a hypothesis that explains everything explains nothing. So we've seen that creationism fares very badly when compared against scientific standards. But what about, how is it from theologically? In particular, how does creationism fare against LDS theology? And I would like to argue that the answer is equally badly. First of all, creationism is founded on the assumption of an infallible Bible. In contrast, while the LDS Church believes that the Bible is the Word of God, there are several caveats. The Bible is incomplete. It has numerous errors of translation. Plain and precious material has been dropped. Certain segments, such as the Song of Solomon, are of dubious inspiration. Certain passages, such as Eve being formed from Adam's rib, are to be interpreted figuratively. And in general, the Bible and even other scriptures are subject to official interpretation by the First Presidency. The scriptural texts themselves are not the final authority. Even Joseph Fielding Smith once wrote, "Even the most devout and sincere believers in the Bible realize that it is, like most any other book, filled with metaphor, simile, allegory, and parable, which no intelligent person should be compelled to accept in a literal sense. The Lord has not taken from those who believe in his word the power of reason. He expects every man to take his yoke upon him to have the common sense enough to accept his figure of speech in its proper setting, and to understand that the Holy Scriptures are replete with allegorical stories, faith-building parables, and artistic speech. To expect a believer in the Bible to strike an attitude of this kind and believe all that is written to be a literal rendition is a stupid thought." That's Joseph Fielding Smith. And even from the beginning, church leaders have been relatively flexible on these issues. Brigham Young said, "As for the Bible account of the creation, we may say that the Lord gave it to Moses, or rather Moses obtained the history and traditions of the fathers, and from these he picked out what he considered necessary, and that account has been handed down from age to age, and we have got it no matter whether it is correct or not, and whether the Lord found the earth empty and void, or whether he made it out of nothing or out of rude elements, or whether he made it in 6 days or as many millions of years, is and will remain a matter of speculations in the minds of men unless he give revelation on the subject." James E. Talmage said, "The opening chapters of Genesis and the scriptures related thereto were never intended as a textbook of geology, archaeology, earth science, or man science. Holy scriptures well endure, while the conceptions of men change with new discoveries. We do not show reverence for the scriptures when we misapply them to faulty interpretations." So, goes on like this. Here's just a comment from B.H. Roberts. "To limit and insist upon the whole of life and death to this side of Adam's advent to the earth some 6 or 8,000 years ago, as proposed by some, is to fly in the face of facts so indisputably brought to light by the researcher of science in modern times. To pay attention to and give reasonable credence to their research and findings is to link the Church of God with the highest increase of human thought and effort. On that side lies development, on the other side lies contraction. It is on the former side that research work is going on and will continue to go on, and future investigation and discoveries will continue on that side. Nothing will retard them, and nothing will develop on the other side. One side leads to narrow sectarianism, the other keeps open the spirit of a world movement with which our new dispensation began. As between them, which is to be our choice?" So, there are a few other things. I'm sort of out of time here. I'd just like to mention that I think it should also be pointed out that the creationist movement is only promoted by a very small segment of the Christian community. The Catholic Pope has declared just 3 or 4 years ago that evolution is more than just a theory. Mainline Protestant churches have made their peace with this many years ago. Recently there was a conference over in Berkeley that called Science and the Spiritual Quest. What was remarkable is numerous very famous scientists came and described their religious faith and how that they see that the two is not in conflict, in fact is mutually supportive. Many books have come out now that have intelligently discussed these issues, but they're not being written by these creationists. They're written by knowledgeable scientists, usually with mainstream Protestant or Catholic affiliations, who are honestly trying to seek a harmony between science and religion. Just let me read one more quote before I so one of these writers has observed, if God were a magician or a dictator, then we might expect the universe to be finished all at once and remain eternally unchanged. If God insisted on being in total control of things, we might not expect the weird organisms of the Cambrian explosion, the later dinosaurs and reptiles, or the many other wild creatures that seem so exotic to us. We would want our divine magician to build the world along the lines of a narrowly human sense of clean perfection. But what a pallid and impoverished world that would be. It would lack all the drama, diversity, adventure, and intense beauty that evolution has in fact produced. A world of human design might have a listless harmony to it, and it might be a world void of pain and struggle, but it would have none of the novelty, contrast, danger, appeal, upheaval, and grandeur that evolution has brought about over billions of years. Fortunately, the God of religion is not a magician, but a creator, and we think this God is much more interested in promoting freedom and the adventure of evolution than in preserving the status quo. In summary, creationism is not legitimate peer-reviewed science. It does not deserve to be presented on a par with conventional science in public schools. As courts have correctly ruled so far, creationism is thinly disguised evangelical biblical literalism. And this creationism is, as one writer has observed, merely the old creationism in designer clothes. Furthermore, either form of creationism contrasts sharply with fundamental LDS beliefs, which teach of harmony between science and religion, and which describe a rational, comprehensive God who works within rather than beyond the realm of natural law. Thank you.
I tried very hard to find someone to respond to David's comments. We thought we had somebody who had to back at the last minute. So before we start, we turn the time over to Dave, there are a couple of thoughts that I'd like to share with you as I read David's paper. First of all, as I follow the discussions that go on the Irene L. list, and every time evolution comes up and it takes its turn, and the Orthodox or the fundamentalist members of the list always bring up the quotes from Joseph Fielding Smith and Man, His Origin and Destiny and so on and cite them as their authorities and so on. It goes on and on and on, and finally we have to come back to this very statement that David referred to, and I think David has often had to quote it himself, where he says, leave geology, biology, archaeology, and anthropology, no one of which has to do with the salvation of the souls of mankind, to scientific research while we magnify our calling within the realm of the church. And that's the official stand of the First Presidency that oftentimes people like David have to fall back on to silence the arguments that are used from fundamentalist members of the church for our salvation. And the net result of that is that we lose so many bright, intelligent, thinking people, and that affects their salvation. And so I think that really, you know, in the sense that we have to rely on that so many times to stop ridiculous arguments, it ends up being one of the problems that we face in finding some way to get a dialogue going with our intelligent people. A couple of other thoughts that came to my mind. David mentioned the notion of how creationism fits together with the LDS theology, and that we as LDS members believe the Bible to be the Word of God, and then have the appropriate caveats about how it's incomplete and there's some errors and so on. But we never stop at that point and analyze what the Word of God means. And we say it's the Word of God, and that's it. Okay? So the Word of God means that whatever He says, with the few caveats that are there, and we don't stop and think, what is it that God was really trying to tell us, and do we have to accept a literalist point of view from these scriptural points? And maybe God wasn't trying to talk to us in those terms, and perhaps we should spend some time understanding how the scriptures really do represent the Word of God, and whether or not they do in the first place, and whether they were evolved themselves from thoughts of people who wish that that's what God was saying to it. And then finally, I'm glad Dave took the time to read that comment about if God were a magician or a dictator, we would expect the universe to be finished all at once and remain eternally unchanged. When I read that, it sent chills down my spine, because when I was a young missionary and I served in Brazil in the 60s, President T.D. Brown came to our mission one time and he spoke, and I was a fairly experienced missionary at that time, so one of my assignments was to be a translator for the Brazilian missionaries that were serving in the mission at that time. And so I was in the back of the room just concentrating as hard as I could to keep up with President Brown and translating his speeches, his talk into Portuguese, and all of a sudden he stopped and he looked out at us and he quoted something that I believe is written somewhere in his words, but it was so powerful that I was taken away breathless, and I couldn't even. He said, to the effect that God did not finish the creation. He left it incomplete. He left the dams unbuilt. He left the city unbuilt. He left the plains unbuilt. He left all of things so that we could become creators, so that we could be stimulated into studying and understanding this sort of thing. And if indeed God had been a magician and done it all himself all at once and finished it all at once, imagine how dull and unexciting and boring our lives would be. The whole beauty of the fact that we have a world that continues to be created and evolve is what gives us something worth seeking, something worth going on for, something worth investing into what we are and who we can become. And so I think that's an important aspect of this discussion about evolution. So that's my comment. Thank you. Question?
Yes,
Kim.
Just thinking what Richard said, that, you know, we say the Bible is word by God, we don't think about what that means. There's been, who in the last 4 years has the church would say, well, Moses got the Bible from God. Well, anyway, he got the traditions of the fathers, and he picked out what he thought was necessary, and we've got it whether it's right or not. I mean, where is Brigham Young today? there's such carefulness about not saying anything that could possibly get anybody off the track. I'm not sure what it is, but I mean, the optimism that we can understand and that we don't have to straitjacket ourselves whenever we're thinking, it's just wonderful to be reminded of this stuff.
Right.
It also calls for an examination. What are the forces at work that we're so afraid of that we can't think by certain thoughts?
Right.
I think, again, that several studies have been made of the church's posture to that the Joseph Fielding Smith Bruce R. McConkie version, which is dominant today, but that's really only a minority voice. Any number of church leaders earlier and even some later have argued, you know, realized that, hey, it's futile to battle the scientific world, and let's try to find a harmony. And yet, for some reason, maybe just the popularity of Mormonism, the Bruce R. McConkie version is dominant, but it's an anomaly, really, in a historical setting.
You know, it's really sad
One last question here.
This is
I had to skip over that part of my paper, but this is, to me, the most compelling reason why we should reject it. This notion of that God created the earth and universe with an appearance of age. The creation is going great length to try to justify this. To me, this is so utterly and completely in opposition to our concept in the LDS Church of a rational and a comprehensible God, and one that loves and leads us to truth. It's just the epitome of the opposite philosophy, and just on that reason alone, that God is the great, the ultimate deceiver. You know, He has planted evidence throughout the universe and in throughout the earth in a deliberate attempt to mislead diligent seekers of truth. This is a repugnance. On this basis alone, we should reject creation.
Thank you.
My paper is on my website at dhbailey.com. Do you think this paper
is available on the website?
Yes.
DHB or David H. Bailey?
Either way. Okay.